And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, we all know what's going on in our economy. The banks are failing. The investment companies are failing. The largest home mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are failing. And now one of the nation's largest insurance companies is failing. AIG, of course, if you haven't heard already, was about to go into bankruptcy, so the U.S. government bought it off. And that's just $85 billion. Just an $85 billion loan. Well, I mean, what's that? That's only... Oh, let's see here. 30,000 dollars in American. Hope I did my math right there. Yeah, 300 million. In any case, it's a lot of money. Maybe it's just $30 in American. Whatever it is, $85 billion is a lot of money, and it's going to a failed company. And you might ask yourself, well, why are these companies failing? And the answer really is very clear. You see, it used to be that the government would regulate banks, investment companies, brokerage firms, insurance companies. Ever since the Great Depression of 1929 through the 30s, we understood that unfettered capitalism doesn't work. In fact, if you look back 100, 110, 20 years ago, when America truly was probably the most unfettered capitalist country in history, that's when you had not only an extremely few, small number of very, very rich people. That was the time, of course, of the Carnegies and all the wealthy oil magnates and so forth. But it was also a time when the great, great vast majority of Americans were poor. It was also a time when the business cycle ran wild. People forget that prior to 1929, there was the panic of 1896. And these business panics would happen time and time again. And so a number of things were established by Franklin Roosevelt, a few by Woodrow Wilson, in fact. But the idea was by the 1930s that the government would be firmly in control of the economy. Not that it would control everything. It wasn't a command economy. The United States is far from a socialist economy. And I support that, by the way. I'm not a socialist. I never have been. But nor am I an unfettered capitalist. I've always believed that you need a combination of socialism and capitalism to make any country's economy work and be fair. But even if you don't care about equity, even if your issue is not whether people are treated well or not, say you don't care about that, and all you care about is a running, functioning economy, even then, I would argue, even then, you don't want unfettered capitalism. And the events of this week have proved it. You see, when you allow banks and insurance companies and brokerage firms to do whatever they want to do, they end up making short-term churning of profits that end up in the long run to be bad investments. You see, investment houses like Lehman Brothers, which went bankrupt just a few days ago, they make their money off convincing you to change your mind. Now, if you're making an investment, sometimes it's right to change your mind. I mean, you know, if I were investing in, pharmaceutical companies, and I saw that George Bush is president, or oil companies, I see George Bush as president, I know that he's going to take a bunch of taxpayer money and funnel it into these corporations. I might want to invest in them. And I might not want to invest, say, in educational companies, because I know that Republicans in control, education will be a last priority. People do certainly have a right and should change their investments. But if you're an investment broker, if you're on the inside, if you're working Wall Street, you make more money by making as many transactions as possible. It's no wonder that last year, in 2007, Goldman Sachs handed out some $13 billion in, not profits, but in bonuses. Just bonuses. to its employees. I guess they had a really good year. Hey, you did a really good job this year. Here's $1 billion. But what does a good job mean? A good job means you were churning, you were buying, you were selling. Didn't matter whether it was a good buy or a good sell. It didn't matter at all. Didn't matter if you were buying homes just when home prices were falling. Didn't matter. If you were selling, you were a really good middleman. And it doesn't really matter what your customers think. You were churning. Every churn gets a commission. Every commission adds to those billions of dollars in bonuses. And so what happened? What happens is the whole thing falls through. It's not like this hasn't happened before. I don't have to go back to 1929 to think of a time when unregulated banks and unregulated insurance companies and brokerage firms caused trouble to the economy. I just have to go back 20 years, 25 years, to the time of the savings and loan crisis. I don't know why that seems like ancient history to so many. It was the last time the Republicans were in charge before now. It was the 1980s. It was Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. And people like Charles Keating were in control. Charles Keating, you'll recall, was the benefactor of John McCain, a very rich savings and loans banker. There's not a bank. It's a savings, so a savings and loans operator, whatever you want to call him. Guy that owned a bunch of savings and loans and knew that government regulation was clamping down on his profits. You see, when governments were regulating them and saying, oh, no, you can only do transactions that make sense economically. You can't just push paper around and claim a commission. You have to buy things that actually exist. No, you can't make that loan, sir, because there's no collateral to back up that loan. You know, all those ugly, terrible things that regulators say, they keep our economy safe. Charles Keating didn't want those regulators on his back. So he had a nice relationship with the beer distributor that is the only person who gave John McCain a job outside of the Senate, his father-in-law, his second father-in-law, I should say, Cindy McCain's father. You know, after he ditched the first wife, you remember her, the disfigured model, got rid of her, cheated with Cindy McCain. He worked for her father, beer distributor, for a few months and then ran on the Senate campaign. Well, Charles Keating was very, very helpful to John McCain's campaign. Let's face it, you want to make it in politics today, you need money. And you need benefactors. And those benefactors want something in return. That's just the way Washington works, I guess. I mean, not for Obama, because... well, he really did come from the grassroots. But for standard politicians like John McCain, sure, that's how it works. And Charles Keating put him up and paid for lots of things, campaigns and so forth. And then when it came time for the quid pro quo, Charles Keating went to John McCain and four other U.S. senators. And he said to the five of them, these nasty, awful, terrible American regulators, they're getting in my business. They're trying to tell me what to do. They're trying to tell me I can't make loans of things that don't exist. They're getting in my way. They're blocking my profits. Could you please call off these horrible dogs? And the five senators owned by Charles Keating, one of which being Johnny McCain, said, yes, sir. They wrote letters to the federal regulators, and they called off the dogs. After all, you wouldn't want regulation in your economy now, would you? I mean, the regulation really can mess up a corporation that's just trying to churn empty land into making huge profits. So we all know the outcome, or should know the outcome, of the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s. It's not just that John McCain and the rest of the Keating Five were brought up before Essex charges in the Senate. That's small stuff. That's small potatoes. Okay, unethical senators, tell me something new. You know, that's no different from what Ted Stevens is doing today. No. The real problem with the savings and loans crisis in the 1980s was that you and I and every other American taxpayer had to fork over hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out Charles Keating and his ilk. It's always amazing to me that at the exact same time this was happening, Ronald Reagan was complaining about welfare queens. Remember this? Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. There are poor people that have cable TV. It's awful. There are women who have welfare checks who occasionally buy a bottle of wine. They are wasting American taxpayer dollars to spend $4 on a box of wine, these drunkards, these terrible mothers, these black women. They didn't say it, but it was always understood. Yes, America, you are wasting your welfare checks. You are spending tens of dollars on people that don't deserve it. But the hundreds of billions of dollars that it cost when the savings and loans debacle happened, did it get that much press? Because, you know, when poor people steal welfare money when they should be working hard, not that I approve of it, but it tends to be in the tens of dollars. Not the hundreds, not the thousands, not the millions, not the hundreds of millions. But when rich people use corporate welfare to grab taxpayer dollars, it's huge. Huge. It's not that they're both not trying to get out of the government, right? It's not. But the difference is that poor people are just trying to get through the day. Yeah, maybe the woman needs a little wine. She's had a hard day. But basically, they're just trying to get through the day and feed their children and survive. And rich people are just trying to steal every $1 billion they can. They just need more money. They want more money. I mean, they've already spent everything on their seventh yacht, right? They already have so many homes they can't count them. People in John McCain's tax bracket know that really the only purpose of money is not to buy things because they have all the things they need. It's to show who's winning in the great game of life. It's all about keeping score. And if you've got $10 billion and your neighbor only has $5 billion, phew, you're the winner. You're the winner. Even if you're paying less taxes than your secretary. So the point really is not that hard to understand. Yes, banks are very complex transactional things, and so are savings and loans, and so are brokerage companies. It's really not that hard to understand what happened. People like Charles Keating in the 1980s told the regulators to go away. Senators like John McCain helped the regulators avert their heads. People, presidents like Ronald Reagan, told the regulators, stop bearing down on capitalism. And taxpayers like you and me were stuck with hundreds of millions of dollars of debt added to the pile. Whatever happened to Charles Keating, you know what? I don't know. I think he went to jail for a little while. But the damage he did is far, far greater than any damage that an ordinary drug dealer in the ghetto might do. So fast forward past the 80s. We then go to the 90s. In the 90s, Bill Clinton had a different view. Bill Clinton had the view that, yeah, he supports capitalism. He supports the free market, but he understands that the free market, without somebody looking over them, can run amok. And that the greed of the 1980s leads to not just social inequality. This isn't about socialism here. This isn't about am I my brother's keeper. I believe in that, but that's not my argument I'm making today. We can talk about that later in the hour if you want, how unfair this is. I'm not even going there. I'm talking purely as an economist here, and here's where I whip out my credentials and start bragging about my degree. But as a pure economist, and Bill Clinton understood this, he's a very, very smart person, I can confirm that when you regulate banks and brokerage companies and insurance companies, you know what? The economy does better. Fancy that. When extremely rich people are watched over so they don't steal even more tens of billions of dollars, guess what? The economy runs better. And the dirty little secret of the Bill Clinton years is that the rich got richer. They did. The rich did very, very well under Bill Clinton. And so did the middle class. And so did the poor. everyone did better under Bill Clinton. Every socioeconomic class advanced. The middle American family got $7,000 more a year under Bill Clinton. Compare that to George W. Bush, where the middle American family lost $2,000 a year over the last 7.5 years. The rich got richer under George Bush, too. I concede the point. But the middle class got poor. And the poor got desperately poor. The people who succeed in unfettered capitalism are the people that either break the laws or come so close to the line that what they're doing should be illegal if it isn't. After all, it was one of the first things that George Bush did when he came into office. Anybody remember Enron? Bill Clinton was watching people like Enron. Maybe not even as much as he should have, but under George Bush, all bets were off. And Enron could go and manipulate energy prices and do so purposely to do spikes in the market to help their profits. After all, the goal of a corporation is not social utility. The goal of an electric company is not to provide electricity to you. What a silly thought that the goal of an electric company is to provide electricity. Who would think of something stupid like that? The goal of an electric company is to make money. The goal of an oil company is not to provide oil or energy. The goal of an oil company is to make money. The goal of an insurance company is not to protect you in cases of danger. It's to make money. The goal of a brokerage company is not to help you buy stocks. It's to make money. That's the goal of every corporation. That's what capitalism is about. And you know what? I'm okay with it. As long as somebody's watching them. You know, I think back 100 years ago to Teddy Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican. But like his cousin Franklin, he was as much a progressive as Barack Obama. Theodore Roosevelt believed that Standard Oil and all the large mega corporations were dangerous to America, dangerous to our economy, dangerous to our security. And he set apart breaking apart the big trusts, as they called it in his day. There's no question that Republicans would consider Teddy Roosevelt a socialist today. And yet all he was doing was making sure that the corporations were not all-powerful. The fascinating thing to me about this entire argument is that you always hear Republicans complaining about the government. The government is so powerful. Get the government out of our lives. The government can't do anything right. The government messes everything up. And you know what? Sometimes it does. No question about it. But implicit in the Republican argument is the idea that corporations can do whatever they want. It's as if the government is determined to go against the public interest while corporations really, really care about you and me. That's what their advertising says, right? Must be true. Can't imagine anyone putting up a faulty advertising. Liberals understand just the opposite. We understand government can be imperfect, but we understand that it is we, the people, who are in charge of the government, and if we're not, well, we damn well should be. We can't control the corporations. Heck, even the shareholders can't control the corporations under current law. CEOs run away and make hundreds of billions of dollars as their companies fail. But we can, with effort, work to actually control our own government. That's what the grassroots Obama campaign is all about. A campaign fueled, get this, by a middle donation of $25. Half of all Obama donors gave less than $25, and half gave more. Not a man that's owned by the corporations. And as imperfect as he is, and Show me a politician who is perfect, and I'll show you one who's dead. I think of Paul Wellstone. May he rest in peace. But while Obama is not perfect, he's damn well much better than Republicans. And as we watch these companies being taken over, as we watch unfettered capitalism, as we recognize what failure to regulate these corporations do and does and causes, how can anyone argue that government should be less involved in corporate lives? Interestingly, Sarah Palin is still arguing that government shouldn't be regulating corporations, but she hasn't gotten the new memo from her boss, John McCain, who's done one of those wild flip-flops. This flip-flop must have happened so fast that he got whipsawed. I mean, as the revolving door hit him, it must have hit him in the face and knocked him over. Now, McCain is talking about greed? The man who supported every single one of the Bush bills to stop regulation? I want you to get in here. I want to know your thoughts on Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, their bailouts, the bailouts of AIG, the Lehman bankruptcy that the government allowed to collapse, which is fine. But I don't think they have any idea what they're doing. I think they're just running around like chickens with their heads cut off, guessing. And I don't think McCain has a clue either. So I want to know what you think about government regulation, unfettered capitalism, the market's falling, AIG, the bailouts. Let me know. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll take a little break and give me a call. Let me know what you think.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. So the Fed just dished out $85 billion to AIG after forking over $29 billion to Bear Stearns and getting us all on the hook for hundreds of billions of dollars to back Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. After making one reckless bet after another, Wall Street firms have run to Washington with their tails between their legs, and except for Lehman Brothers, Washington has thrown them some very expensive bones. This is socialism for Wall Street, but it doesn't help the people who are really hurting in this country, especially the people who are being foreclosed upon. God forbid we had socialism for them. For less money, Washington could have backed every one of their mortgages and let them stay in their homes. Since the housing sector was at the epicenter of the financial crisis, the government's backing of individual mortgages, even at a markdown, could have lent some stability to the industry and put an orderly floor on the deflation. This could also have stanched some of the bleeding at the investment firms that had bet badly on the housing market. But rather than put the individuals first, the government has put Wall Street first, and that's socialism for the greediest, not the neediest. I'm Matt Rothschild. And that's how I see it.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back. About unfettered free market capitalism, which Republicans claim to want. I did a show the other day. By the way, I'm going to play some of these shows that I do on Washington local radio on Friday and Monday. So please stick around for that, particularly this Friday between 5 and 6. I want you to hear what some of the people I have had say, because they're claiming that Obama is a socialist. These McCain supporters, using that one word that presumably will make all Obama supporters run away with our tail between our legs. And yet, hey, Matt Rothschild, he's got it right, 100%. This is welfare. This is socialism. This is nationalization of companies. This is corporate welfare. This is government bailouts. This is hundreds of billions of dollars going to wealthy people. Now, look, I understand in the short term the need not to let the economy fall apart. I get that. I get that. As much as I condemn what led to the failure of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I understand why the government has to step in and prevent the whole failure of the system. They're simply too big to fail. It's kind of like the old adage, if you owe a small debt to the bank, then the bank owns you. But if you owe a large debt to the bank, well, you own the bank. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were very important institutions. These institutions, which also began, I believe it's part of the New Deal. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. They may be from the 60s, but I'm pretty sure they're part of the New Deal. Were designed to help Americans get homes. They're good liberal ideas. And then what happened? Some conservative wag said, you know what? These companies are running so well, we should privatize them. We don't want the government lending all these money to Americans. The government never is efficient. Let's let the private people do it. And so they did. Then came the next argument. Oh, government regulation is way too fierce, way too severe. It's getting in their way. It's stopping the free market. It's blocking their profits. Get that regulation out of the way. And so they did. And then the corporations made bad loans. They weren't being watched. They made subprime mortgages. Some of the buyers, let's face it, they knew it was all a joke. There are people that would get into houses, no money down. They knew they couldn't afford it, and the banks knew they couldn't afford it, and it was all one big joke. But hey, when there's no regulators around, you can do what you want, right? When the cat's away, the mouse do play. The mice, I should say. In any case, they messed up. They did all these subprime mortgages. Everyone knew it was around for a crash. But Republicans don't want to regulate those corporations. They were busy funneling money into their pockets, doing suspiciously similar to the same kinds of things that, Charles Keating was doing for John McCain. The number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I would love to hear from anyone who wants to call. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. But what amazes me is that when the Republicans argue, we don't want socialism. No. We don't want government regulation. I had a guy actually call in on the phone. And again, I hope to play this for you at some point. Listen in on Friday or Monday. We're going to play these shows for you. But I actually had a guy call in and challenge me on the economy, which, you know, hey, what can I say? I had to brag about my degree. But he was a true believer in Adam Smith. Adam Smith, of course, is the 1776 economist that talked about the invisible hand. And I got to say, Adam Smith is not entirely wrong. There are many things the free market does right. Many things. When you buy and sell ordinary products, you know, the next gadget, you know, your iPod versus your other kind of phone, whatever, you make a bigger, better thing, you do a lesser price, it all makes sense. But at the upper levels, when you're combining all this stuff together, when you run a corporation, I mean, look, small businesses, let's face it, small businesses, they run on people who are busy working their small business. You got a little shop owner. Maybe she and her husband are working in the store, and they watch the profits, and they try to sell things at good prices and, you know, make a profit. And their profit goes directly to them. And if they don't make a profit, well, they may have to close down their shop. That kind of capitalism works just fine. I ain't knocking that. I actually appreciate that Obama is going to help small businesses, because he should. The small businesses are struggling in America. But when you get to these massive corporations, capitalism stops working. And the reason it stops working is very simple to understand, because I believe in a meritocracy. The heart of what I believe is that if you do good, you should be rewarded, and if you do bad, you should fail. I mean, Republicans want that for teachers, but they don't want it for corporations. And so with corporations, we have perverse incentives where the CEOs can lose hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars even, for their corporations, and still make $100 million on the way out of the golden parachute. If you're a true believer in capitalism, and I am, shouldn't CEO salaries be based on how well they do? Is that too much to ask? Kevin from Brooklyn, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, how you doing?
Been good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm better than most.
It's like falling out of buildings near you, and I know you're in Brooklyn. I just don't know if anyone's jumping out on Wall Street or anything.
Not yet, but I have a feeling it's going to happen.
Okay, because, you know, watch it where you're walking. You don't want some stockbroker falling on your head.
It's strange to me, you know, AIG. You know,
right.
It's like, my thing is, how can an insurance company be broke?
They made bad investments, Kevin. They made bad investments.
Don't you have to have X amount of capital in reserve to pay off policy?
No, Kevin, that's you're just talking like a democratic, liberal, socialist regulator. You want the regulators to watch and see whether they have enough cash? What, are you trying to stop the market? Are you trying to stop the growth of the American economy? Let the free market work, Kevin. Let the people, they don't need to have reserves. Reserves, that's such a 1930s idea. Let them do what they want, and if they fail, we'll just get taxpayers to bail them out.
Yeah, you know, but this is what I kept on saying.
Yes, they're supposed to have reserves, but that's exactly my point, that McCain and Bush and all don't believe that regulators should, you know, the funny thing is regulators don't even cost that much. You know, for $100,000 a year, you can get a pretty damn good regulator. And that one regulator might save us $100 billion a year. So, you know, for $100,000 to save $100 billion, that seems like that's a million to one. That is a bargain.
Yeah, well, the thing is, everything is coming to float with this, you know, Republican regime. And, you know, what I still have a problem with, and thank God, Guy James read that thing of white privilege. This is what it all boils down to.
Well, it's a certain segment of white privilege.
A certain segment. Or
wealthy white privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even poor white privilege, because poor white privilege still believes that it's going to work out for them. They're going to get a piece of it.
That's just ignorance, Kevin. But they poor whites are being completely screwed. They just don't know it.
They like it.
They are being screwed.
No. I think a lot of them, I'm convinced now, a lot of them are enjoying it.
You think so? Poor white rural Americans in, forgive me, Bob, but West Virginia or Alaska or my home state of Tennessee, you think that they're enjoying? Because I don't think they're doing very well. I think they're
not doing well, but it's just knowing that they have one up on people of color.
Oh, well, all right. Well, no, you're right about that.
And they will hold on to that little bit.
That's a very old idea. I mean, white plantation.
It's very old, but It renews itself. It morphs itself every generation.
It does. And, in fact, I was going to say, 200 years ago, look at the Civil War. 140 years ago, people don't recognize that of the Confederates, only one in four whites even owned slaves. Three-quarters didn't. So you had poor whites.
Only one.
That's right. That's right. There were very few real big plantation owners. See, basically, you had the great majority of white people even fighting for the rights of the 10-15% of them, you know, maybe 10% that had plantations or the 25% that had slaves. The great majority of the Confederate Army were poor whites who couldn't afford a slave. So what the heck were they fighting for? What the heck were they fighting for?
It morphs itself. Hello?
I was going to say, the plantation owner could actually, in the Civil War, the rich white plantation owner could actually buy his spot in the Army. I don't know if you knew that.
That I knew.
Right. He could just buy his way out of the draft. So at the end of the day, the people fighting for slavery were the people who didn't own slaves. So all they were fighting for was this idea of white privilege, I guess.
Yeah. But, like, even the term redneck, it's a total perversion. You know where the term redneck originally came from?
At the back of their necks.
No, they wore red handkerchiefs, striking coal miners, one of the progressive movements in West Virginia, and that's where it originated. Socialist whites in Appalachia.
Well, I hadn't heard that, and that may be where it's partly come from. My impression was the idea was that white people working out in the sun got red necks.
It became a kind of bastardization of that, or it got totally twisted. But originally the term redneck, and I saw this on the History Channel, and I'm going to look it up to be more precise.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that I think that it can have more than one source.
Yeah. But that's where a certain segment of the term came from. And, as a matter of fact, it was a very progressive movement to be called a redneck. But it somehow gets twisted within the generation in the ploy to, you know, break up poor white unity and black unity in the South.
But here's the thing, Kevin, that I'm trying to get at, and I don't know that Obama's done it yet, but I'm really hoping that he says something, gives a major speech maybe. I'd love to see Obama give a major speech this week. I mean, today would not be too soon, tomorrow, Friday, on exactly this topic, on corporate bailout, on the idea that if we regulate these companies, it actually helps the companies. That the irony is that for all the companies complaining about regulation, that if you actually regulate them and protect them from themselves, it not only helps the companies and the shareholders, it helps the whole nation's economy. It makes everybody better off. And
it's
the same reason that we have teachers in schools and we don't have the kids running around free all the time and doing what they want to do. You got to have somebody. I mean, look, even our Constitution, which I love our Constitution, you know, particularly as amended. but even if you look back at the founders and ignore things, you know, things like slavery, you notice that the whole idea of the Constitution was checks and balances. Everybody watched everybody. The judiciary
does the
legislature, and they do it purposely because they know that man, as a human being, will grab power where he can or she can. But I think it's more men that do it, unless he's being watched by somebody else.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the same idea with the corporations.
Well, I think we're kind of breaking up, fading in. Hello?
No, I'm here.
Yeah. I think that's why, you know, like, if you ever noticed, the Republican Party always formed these alliances with groups that crave power, like the fundamentalist movement.
Right.
Okay? And somehow, somewhere, I think throughout history, people view questioning authority as a sign of disrespect. And the thing is, if it's done within the proper channels, questioning authority is always a healthy thing, both for the questioner and the person who's in authority.
But what I find fascinating, Kevin, is that you see in the debate, you see, particularly among the poor whites you're talking about and the people in the Republican Party that are trying to manipulate them, they try to switch who the authority is. John McCain is actually running against Washington, even though he's been supporting the status quo for the last 8 years. You find them calling Obama elitist, this, you know, guy from a single mother who grew up, you know, poor in Hawaii and managed to go to Harvard Law School entirely on his own merits. He's the elitist, but the guy who got into the Naval Academy because his father's an admiral and ended up in the bottom 1% of his class, he's the common man. And it's interesting to me, it's not an elitism based on money. John McCain has far more money than Barack Obama. It's not based on family. McCain comes from this distinguished line of admirals. Certainly Obama comes from working class. It's not skin color. I mean, McCain's white. Obama's half black, half white. What it is education. The idea is if you are smart enough to go to a good college, well, you fancy pants, you think you're better than everyone. We don't want smart people running our country. We don't want smart people running our economy. We want dumb ignoramuses because, you know what, we like to think that we're smarter than our president.
Well, in all fairness to McCain, and I'm saying this in all fairness, okay, graduating from the U.S. Naval Academy, even at the bottom of the class, is still no easy feat. And I'm saying that...
I'm
saying that out of being a Democrat. Now, because he's the son and grandson of an admiral, he probably got a lot more breaks in the academy.
Did he was known as a troublemaker. I mean, he was known as someone who would purposely violate the rules. There's a reason why he wasn't in the top 99.
He knew he could get away with it.
That's exactly
but
right.
At the end of the day, they don't just give diplomas away at their academy.
I don't know.
In all fairness to McCain, I give him props for that. The problem that I have with McCain is because
I don't, Kevin. But what we can agree on that. We'll agree to disagree on that one. I don't.
I do get your point that the rules were kind of different for him because of his lineage.
He had a Trump card that other kids didn't have.
Probably so. But still, he has to have done something. You know,
I'm not so sure. How do you get the bottom 1%? I mean, you have to work at that. I don't care if you're just downright stupid. And actually, I don't think John McCain is that stupid. I don't think
he's... No, he's not. He is George W.
No, genius, but I think he's smarter than George W. Bush. But I mean,
I say they're about the same.
Well, maybe.
I say they're about the same.
Bush got the gentleman's C's at Yale. But again, he got into Yale solely because of the affirmative action of his father. You know, he was a legacy.
Oh, yeah. So did Clarence Thomas. He got in because of affirmative action.
A different
kind. Powers that be. You know?
That's a different kind of affirmative action. I mean, I support affirmative action for people who are left out of our society. What I don't support is affirmative action for people who are the best, highest, privileged class of society. Got a real problem.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is... You know, John McCain, it's always a case of, with the conservatives, of look at what the right hand is doing so you don't pay attention to the left. And that's where this whole nonsense of elitism comes from.
Okay. Well, that's true, but I have to say, though it's more than that. You're right that a lot of it is, and that's a great expression, you know, look at the right hand so you don't see what the left hand is doing. I mean, that's... You know, don't look at the fact that the government's taking over all these companies. Obama's a socialist. You know, don't look at the fact that these regulations are failing, causing massive economic panic. Obama wants to raise your taxes, even though he doesn't. No, that's definitely true. But the elitist thing, I think, is more than that, Kevin. I think it's not just sleight of hand.
It's holding on to privileges.
Well, I'm going to use another word, the word that Congressman Westmoreland of Georgia used. I'm going to use the word uppity. Suggestion that Barack Obama and Michelle, they don't know their place.
I've been saying that for the past 3 months before it became popular.
What matters
that? Huh?
I think that's an excuse for people, and they use elitist as an excuse. Look, as someone who attended these elite institutions myself, I can tell you they're very, very different today. Obama's in my generation. We're Generation X. We're different from the generation. under the baby boomer generation, actually, let me start with my grandfather. Under my grandfather's generation, there were quotas. There were actually quotas. I know at Harvard, for example, you could only have so many Jews. You couldn't have more than a specific number. They were quotas used against Jews. There were very few African Americans. There were a few. W.B. Du Bois went to Harvard, but basically it was done. If your father went there, you got to go there. It was very much based on who you know and where you have a certain elite class, and that I think was true in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, starting in the 60s. Starting around the time of the baby boomer era, and some of this went into the 70s. When they started opening these institutions to women, because remember, many of them didn't even open to women until the 1970s.
Well, that's why you have the sister colleges.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton were really the first of that sort of very, very first of that new generation. But by the time Obama came around, by the time I came around, there's actually not that much left over from the legacy system of George W. Bush and John McCain. There's still a little bit. You still get an advantage going to college if your dad or mom went there.
Nowadays it's more, especially with Yale, it's the skull and bones thing.
Well, to some extent, but I got to tell you, it still exists, and I recognize that it does. It's far, far less than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. I mean, I got to give us as a country some credit. We've come a long way. We got a ways to go, but. The great majority of people that were in my class at Harvard or my class at Yale were not children of rich people. They were people who did really well in school. They were people like Barack Obama. What's interesting is that the elite used to be, and in many ways still is, the moneyed classes that have, the Hiltons of the world who, Paris Hilton has money simply because her grandfather had money. And there's some change. America's becoming more of a meritocracy. There are more Barack Obamas and Bill Clintons. I mean, even Bill Clinton's story, again, grew up poor, a child of a single mother, is virtually impossible to imagine 20, 30 years before his time. The point is we're improving, and I think this is a pushback. It's a way of saying, now wait just a minute. And a lot of it's racist, no question about it, but even against Bill Clinton, it wasn't...
A lot of it is class.
Exactly. It's class.
Well, Bill Clinton was not supposed to be a success.
That's exactly right.
He was supposed to be a used car salesman in Arkansas, let's face it.
He was supposed to be Slick Willie, the used car salesman. And what did he do? He went to the great leveler of America, an educational institution. He went to Georgetown. Then he went to Yale Law School. And lo and behold, he got uppity enough to think that he could be president of the United States. He was inspired by John F. Kennedy to think he could do anything. And look, following in his footsteps, Barack Obama, this young black kid, of course he's half black, half white, but for the whites, he's this young black kid who, again, now if the poor whites can do it, now even the black folk can do it, how the heck are we going to run this country?
Yeah, well, again, it all comes
that's
back
what
to...
That's what it means. It's a way of saying to the Barack Obamas and the Bill Clintons, and anyone else, frankly, who achieves the American dream in this world, like you could be an immigrant from India or Vietnam, and there are many, many successful immigrants that have done very well just because they work hard and are talented people. It's a way of saying to them, you need to know your place.
Exactly. Well, take it from someone.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, take it from someone who grew up, who graduated from the poor man's Harvard. Okay. City College.
Okay.
I always believe in the politics of the ghetto, meaning people who come from meager backgrounds are expected, if they want to go above, it has to be at the approval of those who are already in power. And what pissed off a lot of conservatives with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama is that a lot of things, they started bypassing their approval.
Right. Right, they went around them. That was the nice thing about George W. Bush. He was in their pocket. They controlled him. Cheney and Rove and all the oil companies knew that they could get Junior Bush to do whatever they wanted. All Junior Bush wanted, like any good prince, was to prance around and to carry his scepter and to hear Hail to the Chief and to get to wear a flight suit and fly a plane. I mean, George Bush has always reminded me very much and I forget the name of the French king, and I wish I could remember his name, but he was the one who came to power when he was 10 years old and was
Louis
too
the
young.
14th?
I don't think it was Louis XIV. I think it may have been his grandfather. Oh. The 14th, but whoever it was, this was a king who he couldn't run the place.
Cardinal Rochambeau.
And Cardinal Richelieu was the cardinal. Yeah, he ran everything, and he let the king go to the ceremonial functions and carry the scepter and wear the crown. And the kid loved it. I mean, this 10-year-old king loved it. He would go all the way around France, and everyone would cheer him on. And they look at this kid; he's the king, and they'd be excited. You know, it's kind of fun to have an 11-year-old who's king. Probably like it's fun to have Sarah Palin. You know, Moose Hunter, babe to many men. You know, isn't that fun to have her as a leader?
Well,
but just like the prince didn't have any power, Cardinal Richelieu was running everything. Just like George Bush didn't have any power, Karl Rove and Dick Cheney were deciding everything. Sarah Palin certainly doesn't say anything without her minders telling her every single thing she has to say. Republicans like figureheads. They don't want the real people in power to be shown. Cheney and Rove are two of the most secretive people in America today. They're also two of the most powerful.
Oh yeah, and that's why they've propped up McCain, because when McCain was a true maverick, they slapped him down with the iron glove.
Absolutely, and
you know
the only way you can't beat him, you got to join him.
Yeah, and McCain sold out.
That's exactly right. That's why he sold out on everything, and that's why he's failing now, because the man doesn't even know what he believes anymore. He has no idea. He can't remember. Now, my four tax cuts are against them, or four Anwar. Wait, I'm against Anwar, but I'm for oil drilling. I was against the Bush tax cuts, but now I'm for them. I mean, his positions change so often that even he can't keep track of them.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see in the debates what I just hope that they ream him on this, because you know, Obama's made a couple changes. He public financing is probably the most famous.
Well,
but that's something that's very small. I mean, people understand, okay, he's raising more money this way than that way. But McCain has made fundamental changes about important issues.
Yeah. But I just think Obama, and people were criticizing him because of not fighting back, but I think he's just doing the political rope-a-dope. Wait until these debates come around.
Look, I'm hopeful and I'm fearful. I guess Democrat. I mean, I've been reading in the newspaper. A lot of Democrats feel the way I do. We're nervous. You know,
I think Obama. You see, and like I said to Guy, and like I said to Bob. Okay, you have to understand. Okay, and this is where the race comes in. And I'm sorry to, for lack of a better term, I'm using the race card.
It's okay. It works.
Black, the rules are not the same. They're not.
But so why
cannot come off as too aggressive.
Okay, but why aren't you nervous? I mean, look, we won the election.
Because I think for once, Barack Obama is the candidate, and I think he's, I don't want to say the black candidate, but he's the only candidate of color that can get into the White House anytime soon, because first of all, he speaks the language of mid-America.
Well, yeah, he does.
Okay, because me, I would never in my wildest dreams being a Northeasterner have mystic and pig in the same sentence. Never would. I never heard the statement until last week.
Have what in the same sentence?
Lipstick and pig.
Oh, you never heard that before?
No.
You're kidding.
I'm serious.
I'm from Tennessee. People say that all the time down south.
Okay, but like I'm from New York, and now the same essence I've heard of old wine, new bottles.
Same diff.
It's the same. In essence, the same thing.
Pig is that it's just much more expressive.
Exactly, but you know I've never heard it, and that's why I say Barack Obama speaks mid-American language. I don't.
It's a good image. You know, it's actually a very common expression in Congress. I remember Bobby Scott used to
say most of Congress is from rural areas.
Maybe, but Obama's from Chicago, so
but he grew up in the Midwest, so he transcends rural and urban. You understand what I'm saying?
Okay.
It's not just race he transcends. He transcends rural America and urban.
Kevin, I want to believe that, but I'm not sure he gets rural America, or they get him. I don't think
he grew up in Kansas. He spent a good chunk of his life in Kansas.
Oh, no, no. No. His mother grew up in Kansas. He grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia.
But I think he spent some time in Kansas. If you...
He did. He visited. His grandparents raised him for a time, but mostly in Hawaii. I mean, no, he did. His mother has Kansas roots, and I'm sure he would visit there. But,
So I think he gets a lot of rural America, whatever, from feeding off of that time that he did spend in Kansas.
I hope so. I got to tell you, and we only got a couple of minutes left, and thank you, Kevin, for calling in. This has been terrific. I think he needs to really reach out more to rural America, and it's hard to do. I mean, I'm a city boy myself. I'm from Tennessee, so I know rural areas that are very close to where I grew up, but it is a different language, and it's hard. I mean, and he's got to do it, and at the same time, he's got to make it seem authentic. I mean, he can't just go to a hoedown and a square dance and put a piece of straw in his mouth, or if he does that, he'll look like Dukakis in a tank. He's got to reach out.
But I think he can do it. I honestly think he can do it.
Well, I think he can do it with working class people, with people like Joe Biden. But in terms of farmers and rural areas, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, I hope he does. I hope he goes in that direction. Kevin, I want to thank you for a really terrific call.
Okay, thank you.
Hope you'll call in again sometime. My time is about up. Let me just say this on capitalism. At the end of the day, every economy, in my view, needs some measure of capitalism and some measure of socialism. I am not a socialist, purely, and I am not a capitalist, purely. Social programs work, Social Security and universal health care, but if we had complete socialism, well, I think that would fail. I look at the Israeli kibbutz, and I think that it's very hard to work for something where you don't get to keep anything of your own. The trick is the balance. And so don't let anyone call people names. At the end of the day, check out these big, unfettered capitalists. And always remember this week, next time anyone complains to you that Democrats want regulation, remind them of this week. The week when AIG failed and Lehman Brothers and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Bear Stearns. And remind them that these companies, when they fail, always go to the government. And say, if you only care about saving your pocketbook, maybe we shouldn't have unfettered capitalism. That's all for today. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same channel. Coming up next, your rural hillbilly elitist, Bob Kincaid. This is Mark Levine, signing off.